Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Alice Walker's The Color Purple is an unforgettable story of enduring love and triumph over adversity. Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel and the Warner Brothers Amblin Entertainment motion picture, the musical version of The Color Purple is adapted for the stage by Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award winner Marsha Norman, with music and lyrics by Grammy Award winners Brenda Russell, Ali Willis, and Stephen Bray. The John Doyle-directed Broadway revival of The Color Purple opens tomorrow night after a month of previews and boasts a fresh, joyous score of jazz, ragtime, gospel, and blues. The cast includes Cynthia Erivo as Celie, Jennifer Hudson as Shug Avery, Danielle Brooks as Sophia, and our guest, Isaiah Johnson, as Mr. Like many of the actors we welcome to the show, his story begins like this.
I've been doing theater off and on since I was a kid. I think probably my biggest influence was my father. I saw him do a couple plays with touring companies in the Memphis, Tennessee, southern area that I went and saw as a kid. And I just was kind of floored at how happy he seemed after the show in his hotel room when we would go meet him. He was just like, and I was like, wow, I don't see that often. What is that that gives him that pleasure? Of course, watching how effective that form of storytelling was just to the general audience, of course, got me. And I think the first play I ever did was Goldilocks and the Three Bears. I was not Goldilocks. I was Papa Bear. And I think from that point on, I kind of had a hunch that there was something about this performance thing that people enjoyed when I did it. And so cut years later to high school, I started doing some productions in high school that I thoroughly loved, one of which was Ain't Misbehavin'. Post high school, I went to Howard University, was intending to major in political science to do the entire lawyer trajectory, which I knew by the second semester I was not cut out for. I was like, wait, I actually don't like to read this much. And then when they started telling me, like, the first 10 years after you pass your bar, you'll probably be getting coffee for someone or doing someone else's research, I was like, that's not going to cut it. I was walking through the halls at Howard University Theater Arts Department, and I saw Al Freeman Jr., the late great, teaching. And Malcolm X had just come out, where he played Elijah Muhammad, with rave reviews, and I was starstruck. And I was just like, if there was any time in my life when I'm able to get formal training without immediately coming out of pocket, you can pay the loans later. I was like, now's the time to do that. And I was lucky enough to come into the university at a time when everyone who was teaching and running the place, they were all products of kind of the old Black Broadway school. Mike Malone, Reggie Ray, Henrietta Edmonds, whose father was a playwright, Tony Booker. We just had so many, Al Freeman Jr., with so many great professors that I learned from to kind of get started in this business show, as Henrietta would always say.
Did you always sing as well?
I did. I always sang. Both my parents are musicians. They both play the piano and sing. And I got my start, of course, like everyone else, a lot of people singing in the church. And then it kind of just progressed from there. So I would probably used to consider myself a musician first. Of course, after Howard University, going to grad school at NYU for acting, totally changed the course of my being a musician first love. I definitely love communicating first and foremost. What I learned in grad school was how to communicate music with words.
What got you to NYU? How did you decide New York, that's where I should be next?
Kind of like my start in undergrad, I got to New York. I was here for a year. I was catering and bartending and doing everything but acting. I was auditioning a lot.
Sure.
And enjoying that process for the most part. When I stopped being able to enjoy the process of auditioning is when I decided to apply for grad school to get my MA in theater education through the Steinhardt School of Education. 2 days after I got my denial letter, after a very good interview process, a very good application process, I got a call from NYU grad school to come audition for the program. And that was like on a Friday, so I went in on a Monday or a Tuesday and auditioned, and I got accepted. And the rest is history. It definitely started the course of my professional life here in New York. Prior to New York, I had worked in most of the theaters in Washington, D.C. That's where I got my professional start, where I joined the union and
we're talking about a musical today, eventually, when I do eventually get to what you're working on right now, and I promise I will. But you've also done Shakespeare.
Yes.
When did you first do that?
I actually started studying Shakespeare in grad school. It was something that I never thought I would do until I got older, because of course we go and see a Shakespearean play, most of the time we see older actors. What I didn't know was that at the time when I was coming out of grad school, 2010, people were starting to cast Shakespeare with a little bit younger demographic, trying to get the younger demographic in the audience. And so I totally, by, you know, a shot of luck, found out that a good friend of mine was no longer going to be able to do his role in Merchant of Venice at Shakespeare in the Park because he was going off to do TV. Him and I being friends, I found out that information, and I immediately called my agent. I said, hey, listen, a guy that I know I would be cast with alongside, I see him in every audition, is leaving this role. Can I get in the audition room, or at least can I send in tape? I was at the time in California doing another show. And so they allowed me to send in tape, Dan Sullivan. And I don't know what he saw, but he allowed me to come in for a callback. I flew to New York, having left the show that I was doing at the time in California. They were getting ready to go to an extension. But I said, hey, listen, I can't do the extension. I've just been cast in Merchant of Venice with Al Pacino.
So you told a friend of yours that you were leaving, and he called his agent and got that.
Exactly, exactly. I'm sure that's exactly how it happened. Yeah, but everything happens for a reason. And that kind of started my love for Shakespeare. And from that point, I think the next Shakespearean play I was able to do was Richard III with Kevin Spacey and Sam Mendes. We toured that for about a year, which you can catch the highlights of that in the documentary Now, which is on Netflix, Instant Watch. And then after that, I had this amazing opportunity to play Othello. Once again, an opportunity that just fell in my lap, with someone who left the show 2 weeks into performances. And I got a call from a friend say, hey, we're working on this production of Othello. Would you mind coming in to take over the role? And at the time, I was in between jobs, and so I had gone back to kind of bartending, and I was like, yes. I, at this point in my life, am willing to read the Star Spangled Banner on a street corner if it means that I can have some material to work on. And I went in, and it was the best class I ever took, that experience. Somehow, I think it was because I was really hungry for work, and I think I was in a good place emotionally and spiritually to handle any challenge that came my way at that point in time. And somehow I was able to get off book for the role of Othello with the cuts that they had made, of course, before I came on, in maybe like a week and a half, and, you know, closed out the production. And it was one of the most amazing artistic experiences I've ever had.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
Tell us about your experience in Peter and the Starcatcher.
Oh man, that was so good. I was just coming off of the Richard III tour. We had ended our tour in New York, and I needed a job. And so the opportunity came about. I read the script that Rick Ellis had done, and I was just laughing my ass off in the dressing room. Everybody's like, what the hell are you laughing at? I was like, my next job. It was just such a great script. And I went in, and Roger Reese and Alex Timbers gave me an audition for Captain Robert Falcon Scott. And we just had such a great time in the audition room. And I could immediately tell that Roger was someone who just loved actors to play, loved actors to just come in and just be free in your work. And that was so refreshing to experience in a Broadway audition, because a lot of times you feel the pressure that you have to like be this amazing, like you have to be better than Norm Lewis in the audition room. And you can't be, but you have to at least give them that. But he was like, nah, man, let's just play around. And I was like, that's so great. And I miss him dearly. He was such a loving, loving, loving man.
Had you done professionally much comedy before that?
No. Not where I would say that, yeah, people knew me as a comedic actor. It wasn't that at all. But, I mean, comedy was definitely in the house when I was growing up a lot. So, I don't know. I think comedy is like, it's just rhythm. So if you can feel the rhythm, if you can hear it, then you can totally do it. And you can get better at it.
You are now the matter at hand. You're currently in previews in Color Purple.
Yes.
How did this project come to you?
I don't know. I don't know if I could actually say this technically. However, it came to me because I was in Seattle at the time working on some other projects. I was looking on the Actors Equity website breakdown, and I saw that they were doing auditions for Color Purple. So I called my agents. I said, hey, have I been submitted for this? Why haven't I been seen? I haven't got a phone call about this at all. And whatever they did, they probably sent my headshot and resume and I don't know, whatever. Anyway, that phone call to my agents got another ball rolling to get me in that room. And so I flew from Seattle back here to join them for the callback weekends. And once again, met the amazing John Doyle. And we just had such a great time in the room. And once again, full circle, it came back to someone who just wanted the actors to just be free and play in the room. Don't get away from being presentational. And that's the work that we've continued to do in this production. And it's been amazing.
Your role is, I don't know what word I should use, because tricky is too slight, but it is complicated, I imagine, hard to tap into and play.
Yes.
So tell us how you've approached it and what you're learning and bringing and taking from the role.
Yeah. I approached this role with the intention of finding out what type of African-American man this was. And I say African-American specifically because, obviously, that's the world that we're living in, and it's very specific to the early 1900s. It's very specific to post-slavery. It's very specific to problems that any man who comes from a low economic status would deal with. It definitely stems from a man who grew up in a broken home, a man who received parenting that we would definitely call in this day and age questionable, if not illegal, abusive. How does one who grows up in that environment, how do they deal with their own lives when they come into conflict? You know, when you grow up with nothing and you try to get a start in life and you feel that life is continuously presenting challenges that equal nothing, how do you deal with that? At some point, it's got to eat away at your spirit. More importantly, it's got to eat away at your self-preservation and your point of view about yourself. You know, so it's like, okay, I'm trying really hard. Life has given me shit. At a certain point, I'm going to begin to think that it's me. It must not be life. It must be me. And once I accept the fact that I'm not worth a prosperous life, then that affects everything I do. And everything I do affects everyone around me.
And how do you, Isaiah, inhabit that despair every night and then be okay every morning?
Sure. Well, I think you just kind of have to, with any character, you kind of chart through what are the actions in the play that change the course of their objective, right? So at the beginning of the play, Mister's objective is just to find a wife. Simple. Just to find a wife. He's intending to find a beautiful wife. He's told, no, you can't have that beautiful wife. You can have over here who works hard. But you can't have the beautiful wife who knows how to read, who's going to be a school teacher, who you think would be a better match for you. You can't have her. He doesn't deal with rejection very well, especially since before the play starts, we find out that the love of his life, Suge Avery, he also was unable to have because his father told him no. That's not a very good start for someone who we want to be prosperous. He discovers through his relationship with Celie, that she, being able to withstand all of the conflict that he imposed on her and all of the conflict that the world imposed on her, somehow she was still able to hold on to some inkling of love for herself. Of course, that's connected to her love for her sister Nettie, and then her love for Suge Avery, and then her love for Sophia. And from these women, she gets filled with the confidence to leave Mister. Of course, he didn't see that coming until the Easter dinner where it all crashes. And I think in that moment, he sees in her someone who is unbreakable. And I think he becomes intrigued as to what the source of that is. And then from that point, we start to see a mister who is now attempting to live a more prosperous life. But it has nothing to do with money. It has nothing to do with riches. It has nothing to do with having the love of your life, quote unquote. It has to do with how you treat people on a day-to-day basis. How you begin to see the world. It has to do with your love of the sea and seashells. Simple things.
Isaiah Johnson plays Mister in the Broadway revival of The Color Purple. The show opens at the Bernard B. Jacobs Theater in New York City tomorrow night. To learn more, visit colorpurple.com. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.